The Breakup. Broken Rat. He's up there with Kelly, Peter Lyla, as an Australian folk hero. And we all think we know the story. I certainly thought I knew a lot about The Breakup, only to discover that I've been abysmally ignorant. We know that he was a charming poet and horseman who knocks about the Australian bush and in 1900 winds up fighting in South Africa, where for that grand occasion they'd invented things like the concentration camp, and where he will be court-martialed for shooting prisoners of war. He's executed shortly thereafter. Now, debate has raged ever since over whether he was a murderer or, simply to put it in the words of one of his co-accused, a scapegoat of the empire. And we've had people on the program in the past who have seen him absolutely not only as a hero, but as some sort of military martyr. Peter Fitzsimons has written a newie on The Breakup, and we welcome him back to the Little Wireless program.
Philip.
How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for that kind introduction. Yeah, it's been, for me, an extraordinary journey on Breakup Rant. I mean, I grew up the stories with Breakup Rant, and I was always a bit interested because my grandfather had fought in the Boer War. And, you know, we were proud of Grandpa. Mum and Dad had been in the Second World War, but Grandpa had been in the Boer War. And the genesis of the book was I was on the Council of the War Memorial for, I think, 6 years. And at one point I'd voted for funds to be put towards a Boer War Memorial. I went to the opening, and as I approached, I'm sure you've seen it, that bronze sculpture just about 200 metres down from the War Memorial. And as I approached the sculpture, there was a plaque in front of it, and I started reading it, and it was the letter from a trooper to his mother from the front of the Boer War, and I read it, and it was by Frederick Harper Booth from the 2nd Victorian Light Horse, and that's my grandfather writing to my grandmother, great-grandmother, and that sort of put in my head, well, I should do a book on the Boer War, given that Grandpa's letters are there. We had Grandpa's letters and diaries. I started looking into the Breakup Rant. I worked with three or four researchers at one point, two of whom had military PhDs. And, of course, I had the advantage of working in 2018, 2019, 2020, when you've got the internet and you can get into archives all over the world and you can access documents that have not been collated before. And what I found was really quite shocking to me, that, you know, how did this guy turn into a hero? This guy was the author of the worst atrocities of the Boer War perpetrated by British forces on the Boers.
Now, Peter, let's walk it back. Let's look at his birth in England, humble and circumstances, although he made some claim to be the son of a British admiral, or failing that, a duke or major general.
Yep, all of that. And he was an absolutely inveterate and extremely skilled liar. And it was fascinating for me that, you know, with my research, it's just going through layer upon layer upon layer of lies, and that had lasted centuries, that had lasted 120 years, because they were sort of plausible. You know, some of them, they had enough truth in them that they could last. And the most enduring lie was that when he turned, I mean, there was a touch to jump forward for a moment. There was a touch of Deliverance, the famous film, not Deliverance, Apocalypse Now is the one I'm thinking of. Apocalypse Now. There was a touch of Apocalypse Now to the story of troops in the Badlands that have gone rogue. And that's what happened in the latter part of the Boer War. They put Breakup Rant with the Bushveld Carbineer.
Mate, slow it up. Walk it back, because we've got tons of time to tell the mighty saga. And to mention, as I did in the beginning of the program, some of the extraordinary people from Conan Doyle to Rudyard Kipling to Banjo Paterson who have a part in it. He arrives in Australia, in Townsville, 1883, and he travels widely and has many an adventure, although misadventure would seem to be more appropriate. He was an absolute con man.
Totally. And frequently put in prison, But he had a lot of charm. You know, he had a great deal of charisma, and by God, the man could ride horses. You know, if you were looking, if they'd had films back in 1880, 1890, which they didn't, but if they were looking to cast The Man from Snowy River, the poem that was written by Banjo Paterson about that time, you couldn't go too far past Breaker Morant in terms of his ability with a horse. And he was all through Queensland, all through New South Wales, all through South Australia. And, you know, there was the legend of Breaker Morant. He spent a lot of time in Sydney. And at one point, Banjo Paterson, uncle, wrote to Banjo Paterson, said, "Look, I'm sending a bloke your way. He's been up here in Queensland. He's in and out of trouble all the time. I don't know what's wrong with this bloke, but, you know, he's going to come your way. He's interesting, and he's a bit of a poet." And he was a bit of a poet, and he was pretty good. And he turned up at Banjo Paterson's offices, and they had a fabulous afternoon. And he at the end of it, he said, "Oh, look, I'm just caught short. Do you have a fiver? You got £5 on you?" And Banjo Paterson had the sense to, you know, to hold it back and say, "Well, no, actually I don't," you know, because he'd been warned. But he was fascinated by the guy. And, you know, whether or not Breaker Morant was the inspiration for the famous Banjo Paterson poem, "The G-Bung Polo Club," is not sure. But there was always, that was certainly what Breaker Morant always claimed. And, you know, the lies. And fascinatingly, the woman that Breaker Morant married is another famous Australian identity, Daisy Bates. And Daisy Bates, who went on to great...
See, fame. I'd never known that.
No, well, I hadn't known that either. And it was... The marriage only lasted 6 months.
And he didn't pay the vicar.
That's right. And you know, he was always in trouble with the law, and, as I say, in and out of jail. But again, this roguish charm, but also always running up debts. So he would move from town to town, always in trouble, always running up debts, always some people swearing by him. Because if you had to have a beer late into the night with somebody, I mean, a man that could tell stories, that could write poetry, that could tell you yarns, you know, some of which were true, and then the great stories about, you know, "I'll bet I can take my horse. Let's go out to the yard gate, put a candle on either side, and I reckon I can take my horse blindfolded. I'll jump over it." And you couldn't do that. He couldn't do that. Could he? And, you know, the town people would gather round and they'd take bets either way. And invariably he would go. He would jump over it and that kind of thing. And always, but, you know, always down to his last pennies, and, you know, would borrow money and move on.
Well, so he wouldn't. He'd stay in posh hotels and Scarpa without paying the bills. I'm just looking at the charge sheet here. He nicks 32 pigs. Mm-hmm. He gets into trouble, gets 3 months in the slammer for selling the same horse twice. And so when he's not breaking horses or selling them twice, he's trapping dingoes, he's yarding scrub cattle, he's playing polo, and he's fighting and drinking, as you say, anything but work.
You there? Yep. Sorry, I just didn't hear that last part.
So he did anything, as you say, but work.
Yes, anything that worked, anything to stay alive, but and to pay his bills. But by 1890, by the late 1890s, he's sort of running out of road to run down. And the Boer War by this point has taken off, and this is an opportunity for him to get back to England to you know, a free passage back to England, but also to do, you know, at the Boer War, what is he good at? He's good with horses. He's good, you know, and he's a good guy. He's good to be around with men. You know, he's a good leader of men. And so at this point, he's in Renmark in the Riverina. He travels down to South Australia. He joins the second Australian contingent going to the Boer War. And off he goes, and he lands in Cape Town, and very quickly he gets a job. He's assigned to be a messenger for a famous British war correspondent, and so there he is. You know, Breaker Morant. He's at the front, and he's running messages back and forth, and he's highly regarded as somebody who can find his way through the lines and a brilliant horseman, and all the rest.
I'm talking to Peter Fitzsimons, whose enthusiasms are as infectious, of course, as COVID. This is LNL on RN, and we're discussing Peter's new book on Breaker Morant. So, the prelude to the Second Boer War is what?
Not the Second World War, the Boer War.
The prelude to the Second Boer War.
So, basically, again, I'd never really appreciated this, what the Boer War was about, because it's never really written about this part of it. But basically, it's white fellas fighting over black fellas' land. You know, this is African land. And what happened, just to give the full context, is the Dutch land on the southern tip of South Africa, what we know as, well, the African continent, in the early 1600s, they establish a port there. The Brits push them out, and there's a fight, brief fight between the Brits and the French over who'll get Cape Town, which is hugely significant. Through the 1700s, they push the Boers to the north, and then the worst of all possible things for the Boers happens in the latter part of the 1800s. They find diamonds and gold. At this point, the Brits say, well, we want that too. And so there's the First Boer War, which is the fight between the British forces and around about 1880, latter part of the 1870s, 1880, and then there's a settlement, and then it's in the latter part leading into the Second Boer War that it all starts again, and because they want the diamonds and the gold, and at this point, Australian forces, they're Australian colonies at this point. Australia has not yet become federated. So the word goes out, the mother country's in trouble. We need to send forces. So each of the Australian colonies raise forces to go to the Boer War. And the Australian forces of the Australian colonies are highly regarded because they're composed mostly of men who can ride and shoot and live off the land.
Let me quote Conan Doyle here, who was on active service out there observing the war, and he said, throughout the whole African army, there was nothing but the utmost admiration for the dash and spirit of the hard-riding, straight-shooting sons of Australia and New Zealand. In a host which held many brave men, there were none braver than they. However, let it be said, the Boers themselves were remarkably good fighters, weren't they? They were pioneers of guerrilla tactics.
Yes, they were, and they could live off the land. And I remember when I was a footballer when I was a footballer 30 years ago, I was in a conversation with the South African man, and we were talking about apartheid, and I said to him, well, you'll have to dismantle apartheid. And he said, you know, they're trying to push us out. I've got nowhere to go. I'll fight for apartheid. And to a certain extent, not without opening that whole thing, but the Boers had nowhere to go. They were going to fight. And the British way of fighting was, you know, in European wars, if I take your capital, I win, because that's the way it is. And so what happened in the early part of the, 1900, is the British forces, with huge numbers of men, like tens of thousands of men, start from Cape Town, and they push forward on railways and in convoys. Among them was my grandfather, and, you know, one of his letters, he talks about basically if you started when the convoy was starting out and you were if you started on horseback at the back of the convoy and rode to the front of the convoy, you wouldn't get there till dark. You know, it was that big, and it was this mass of the British Empire pushing the Boers back. And so they took Bloemfontein, and then they took Pretoria, and it was felt that, well, we've got Bloemfontein, we've got Pretoria, we've got your two capital cities, that's the end of it. Well, the Boers said, well, no, it's not the end of it. We're basically heading for the hills. We're going to fight on. And so that began to be the setup to where Breaker Morant came into play. But before we get to that, I mean, the story that most stunned me, that I knew nothing about it, and I just loved the story, and I might say the people that have read the book loved the story, the Battle of Ellen's River, which was essentially Australia's Gallipoli before Gallipoli, where you had the Australian forces were atop a hill, a small hill, there's about 300 of them, and they were with about 200 Rhodesians and English, and they were surrounded by 2,000 to 3,000 Boers with heavy artillery. And the Boers surrounding them started pounding and pounding in with the artillery, and the shells started to land among the Australians. And one of the details that, you know, shocked me was about a piece of shrapnel that neatly took out the spine of a horse and slapped down. And, you know, men were dying and arms were missing. And the Australians were composed of a lot of Queensland coal miners who very quickly started digging, were able to get tunnels and were able to defend themselves and protect themselves. And any Boer that came in sight, they would fire upon with extraordinary accuracy. And after 4 days, an emissary from the Boer general comes forward to talk to the English colonel, Colonel Hoare, and says, "We've got you surrounded. We have unlimited ammunition. You're never going to get out of here alive. We're just going to pound the bejesus out of you. You have to surrender. If you lay down your guns and give us your supplies, we will give you free passage. You will get away with your lives." At this point, and this is documented, the colonel says, "You don't understand. I'm commanding Australians up on that hill. Even if I wanted to surrender, and I don't, if I surrendered and went up there and told them I've surrendered, they would slit my throat. We don't surrender." And Australia loved that story of the Australians holding out. And, you know, you get into vainglorious breast beating, and I know in these kind of stories, but it's there. It's documented. The Australians and the English and the Rhodesians, as they were then, Rhodesia, fought magnificently well. But as you say, the Boers, heavily outnumbered, you know, right across the board, they were heavily outnumbered, and they refused to give in. And this gives rise to the next part of the ugliness of the saga. Kitchener pioneered what was essentially a scorched earth policy.
This is the burning of tens of thousands of Boer farms.
It is. And it is basically how are these Boer guerrillas living? How are they living off the land? The GUERILLAS, the Boer guerrillas. How are they living? They're living off the Boer homesteads. They're feeding them. All right, well, if we find you've got anything to do with it, we'll burn down your homestead. And then so they started doing that, and then they basically started burning down all Boer homesteads. And as I say, using my grandfather's letters and diaries, there's a quite upsetting letter where he writes to my great-grandmother, and he says, "You know, we had to burn down this homestead, and the women and the children were weeping, but Mum, I know this sounds tough, but this is what we've got to do. You know, this war won't be over until we've cleaned them all out." And they just kept doing it. And so then the Brits invented concentration camps, and that was what they were called. And these were not like the German infamous concentration camps of the Second World War, designed in the end, you know, the final solution. The first idea was, we have to feed the women and children, so that we'll bring them in the one place and the one time, and we'll feed them there. And the intent was not to kill them, it was to keep them alive. But then disease, dysentery took hold, and they started dropping. And they had terrible conditions, terrible food, and they couldn't keep up the supply. They died in their thousands, ultimately in their tens of thousands. One of my researchers always encourages me. She's a brilliant young woman, Dr. Libby Effney. She always says, "Where are the female stories?" Well, here was the really strong female story of a great English woman, Emily Hobhouse, who's a peace activist, who goes to South Africa, who sees these concentration camps, who takes notes, who writes letters, who is absolutely appalled, goes back to England and says, "We are the British people. This is happening on our watch. This must stop." And so she was an activist there. And so by now we get to 1901, when the last Boers are out in the Badlands in the northern part of what we now know as South Africa, refusing to give in. And here comes the idea of, let us form the Bushveld Carbineers. And the idea of that was basically fighting fire with fire. This was one of many units, but we need to form up men who, most of my men like my grandfather had gone home. They'd served their year, or they'd served their 2 years, and they'd gone back. But those that were left over, okay, can you ride and can you shoot and are you desperate enough to head out into the Badlands and take out the last of the Boers? And the Bushveld Carbineers were formed and Breaker Morant was a part of that. And, you know, he fought well. He was good. He was a courageous soldier in those early days because he could ride on horseback through the night. He could live on little food. He could fire well. He was well regarded by the men. But by God, he was a big drinker. And this was another thing. He was, the other soldiers noted that, you know, late at night, if he had a lot of grog in him, he was not a man to take on.
And okay, let's now talk about the crimes for which he is charged. Mm. And there's a number of them.
Yep. Well, the setup is at one point. So he's, again, we get to where I was with the legend that's lasted 120 years. His justification for the atrocities that he did was that he was best friends with the captain of the Bushveld Carbineers, was Captain Percy Hunt. And he always said from the beginning that when Captain Percy Hunt was killed by the Boers, and he always said he was mutilated by them, and he was my best friend, and he and I were going to marry sisters in Devon, because the Breaker Morant story was that after his first stint in the Boer War, he'd gone back to England very briefly for a few months. He always said, I was there with Percy Hunt and we were about to marry sisters from Devon. And that was the story. And that was one of his lies that is endured in every account, in every book up to now. And one of my researchers has a brilliant son and who's got, you know, put a lot of time into going through every bit of documentation and ended up proving that Percy Hunt was never in England at that time. He was working with the British Army. He was actually working, given that they'd wiped out the Boer governments, somebody had to do the marriage registry, had to run the marriage registry. That was Captain Percy Hunt. And in the months that Breaker Morant said, and he said this in the court-martial as well, that Captain Percy Hunt was back with me in England and we were about to marry sisters. Well, no, he wasn't. He was in Pretoria. Here's the documentation signed by Percy Hunt. So what happens is Percy Hunt, that we get to the middle of 1901, Percy Hunt leads an absolutely suicidal mission against these, but the Boers that are holding out, the Filun in the northern part of South Africa, and it's a suicidal mission, and he charges forth and he is killed. When Breaker Morant is advised of what has happened, is told us what had happened, he rides through the day and the night to get there, and, you know, he insists that Pat Percy Hunt has been mutilated, even though he never saw the body, even though others said, well, no, he wasn't mutilated, he was killed. He launched himself and was killed in a fair fight. Breaker Morant insisted that he was mutilated and basically swore vengeance from this day forth. And he goes out after the men that have killed him in this fight, the Boers. They capture one man, Visser, and Breaker Morant decides then and there, well, tomorrow morning we're gonna shoot him. We're gonna do a court martial. We're gonna court martial him in the field, and we will shoot him. And the soldiers that he first commanded to do this said, "You what? What? No, we're gonna shoot him." And anyway, he insisted, and Visser was shot. And thus began a whole series of atrocities under the command of Breaker Morant, where on the insistence of Breaker Morant, there were six Boers that were shot down there. The issue of the eight Boers, they added up in the end. I think there were 20 Boers that were shot in what we would call in war criminal. Well, the court-martial found that, you know, he had no right to shoot unarmed prisoners like that. And
there's more to it than that, isn't there? He also shoots a missionary who was a witness.
Yes, and this is, look, they all blur into each other. But yes, we went into the whole issue of the missionary very, very deeply. And it was there's so many differing accounts. But yes, there was the missionary that goes by is he's a He's a very good man. He's got a wife and he's got a children, and he goes by and he sees six boars lined up and he says, what's going on? And then he finds out that they've been killed. Breaker Morant basically fears that this missionary is going to report everything. And precisely what happens is very difficult to determine, but there is no doubt that the missionary was killed, and a lot of these missionaries had what they called boys. I used the terminology at the time. You'd never use that terminology now. Boy, African boy, like his helper, that boy also was killed. And it was all, and at one point there were boars that turned. So there were boars that fought, that changed sides and were with the Bushveld Carbineers. At one point, one of the boars that had shot down, had killed the six boars, had been in the firing party that shot the six boars, is furious at what has happened, is disgusted at himself. He goes out on a mission. He goes out on a mission through the high veld with Breaker Morant's right-hand man, and he too is shot down very mysteriously, and it looks like, well, it was Peter Hancock that shot him, and that is the account. And you're going through all transcripts of the war memorial, and there was a fellow, one of the men that I worked with, Frank Shields, who's a terrific man who lives in Sydney, who's been studying this for 50 years. He got these guys on tape, some of the Boer War veterans on tape before they died back in the 70s. And, you know, the transcripts of, well, I saw him shoot him and down he went. And so Hancock was the other one with Breaker Morant that was in the end. There were three of them that were found guilty in the court martial, and two of them, Peter Hancock and Breaker Morant, were the ones that were put up against the wall.
Now, before we go on to that, their last moments. I mentioned already in dispatches Arthur Conan Doyle's report. We had Rudyard Kipling covering the war. Mm-hmm. Winston Churchill.
Isn't that an extraordinary story?
Well, repeat it briefly.
Well, Winston Churchill was, you know, to the manner born. He was the great aristocrat, and he always felt that, you know, he was born under a star. And he goes to the Boer War by the late 1890s. He's a blue blood war correspondent. He feels that, you know, when the Boer War broke out, he was a very highly regarded war correspondent because he'd done wars all over the world. But he said, I've got to go to the Boer War. He goes to the Boer War. And he gets a commission in the army to actually have a rank, but so that it allowed him to be in the front lines. He gets ambushed. He gets imprisoned by the Boers, and he escapes, and he becomes, you know, the great hero in Britain that young Winston has escaped. And at one point he's in a battle, Winston Churchill's in a battle, and bullets are whizzing all around him, and he's giving commands to the soldiers of what to do and how to do it. And, you know, he's got this daring do, and they say, well, why aren't you ducking like everybody else? And he basically says, you know, there's no Boer bullet out there with my name on it, because I'm Winston Churchill. I am born for greatness.
And a man of destiny. Is there any truth in the story that Morant helped defend the jail where he was being kept?
Yes, and that is as shown up in, you know, Philip, there are a lot of movies, of course, that don't age well, that you remember a film from 1980 or 1990 that you think, gee, that was a fantastic film, and you see it again now and it hasn't lasted. Well, I must say that Bruce Beresford's film of 1980-81, that has really lasted well. Bruce Beresford never intended for Breaker Morant to, you know, come out to be a hero. He didn't intend that, and there wasn't as much information now then as there is now. But a lot of those scenes, they're very realistic. And Breaker Morant, yes, while under investigation, while being court-martialed, at some points they're attacked by the Boers. They have to give Breaker Morant a rifle to fire as they give it to Hancock. And, you know, they fight, and they fight well. But again, we're jumping ahead of ourselves, because the thing for me, when Frank Shields, you know, talked to me and helped me a lot with this book, he said, you've added something to it that it hasn't had before, beyond all the new information. I said, what's that? And he said, well, anger. You're angry about what happened. And for me, the untold story of the atrocities committed by Breaker Morant, the untold heroes, are the people that blew the whistle, the people that said, the soldiers that said, we're not going to do this. We haven't come to the Boer War to shoot unarmed men.
Shades of what seems to have been going on in Afghanistan.
Well, what's going on in Afghanistan, we're in a minefield on that one, and we're in a legal minefield on that one. But certainly, for me, the hero in this case, with James Christie particularly, he was a New Zealander, and he'd lost four of his own children in a house fire, and when he joins the Boer War, he's gone to the Boer War basically to get away of the horror of what has happened at home. A very good man, and he is the first one to gather the others to him and say, this is not right, this is not what we are about as men. And they had a justice of the peace with them, and they wrote a document to the colonel to make formal, if secret, complaint, this is what's going on under your watch, and the 14 of them signed it. And given what had happened to others that had complained, who'd been shot in battle, you know, they were taking their lives into their hands. But with great courage, these 14 men signed the document. They send it to the colonel, and sure enough, Breaker Morant is arrested, and as is Hancock, and as is another one, George Whitten, as is another one, Lenihan, and they're put on trial for their lives. And the famous line in the Bruce Beresford film is where they Breaker Morant, very loquacious, and I should have mentioned, you know, like he wasn't the equal of Banjo Patterson as a poet, but he was a pretty bloody good poet. You know, he was good, and he could capture the moments, and he wrote these extraordinary verses which sort of captured what it was to be fighting in the Boer War.
You've got a minute left.
Okay, and so, where has the time gone? And so very quickly, the British prosecutor says him, and this court-martial with Visser, where you had this court-martial in the field and you shot him, was it a court-martial like this? And Breaker Morant says, like this? No, I shouldn't say it was like this. It wasn't comfortable like this. There were no chairs, there were no tables, but we got him and we shot him under Rule 303. And that is from the film, but that's actually what happened. I mean, it really is an extraordinary yarn.
And at the end, the famous last words, shoot straight,
shoot
you bastards.
Shoot straight, you bastards. Don't make a mess of it.
Thank you, Al Sun. We've got to wind it up. And the book is a splendid effort, and I commend it to you highly. We've been talking to Peter Fitzsimons about his new book, Breaker Morant. It's published by Hachette.